You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the Sound and beyond. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Please listen on Wednesdays, 5 o'clock after calendar, and also alternate Sundays at 12:30. Today, I'm very pleased to have as a guest, Lyanda Lynn Haupt. Lyanda Lynn Haupt, and she is an author, an eco-philosopher, an ornithologist, and citizen naturalist. I first met her after she visited Port Townsend and after the publication of her book, Crow Planet. She's also written since then An Urban Bestiary, and Pilgrim on the Great Bird Continent, a little bit about Darwin, not a little bit, but a lot about Darwin. And now we're going to talk today about a wonderful new book called Mozart's Starling. And this is a book, as you might guess, about Mozart, but also about creativity and also about starlings. Now, I have to admit, Lyanda's here. Welcome, Lyanda.
Hi, thank you, Chris.
I do have to admit that the title, I love Mozart, not so much starlings. So please tell us how this book came into being and why you called it Mozart's Starling.
Well, the title and the dissonance you felt is exactly what I had hoped for from people who read the title, because the point of the title is to set these two very, you know, different images in people's mind right next to each other to sort of create, you know, what you said. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, you know, how do these fit? Mozart, one of the most sublime composers in all of, you know, Western music history, and the starling is the most hated bird in North America. So what are their names doing together on the title? So the point is to sort of draw one in with that moment of confusion.
Mm-hmm. So I felt that. And then I started to read the book. And you talk about, it starts on a very personal level, about your personal inspiration for deciding to write this book and your creative process. So how did you decide to write on this topic?
You know, I never meant to write a book about starlings. You know, for me, I'm a nature writer, a naturalist, a conservationist. So it's to write a book, an entire book about this bird that is an ecological disaster in our country was the farthest thing from my mind. And I was sitting at my desk one day, actually working on my last book. And so not even thinking about what to write about next. And I looked out. It was about this time of year, autumn, when the family groups are breaking down after summer and they're starting to gather into their autumn flocks. A group of them was out on the parking strip in front of my house. And as I usually do, I knocked on the window to make them go away because, you know, when so many starlings are around, it's the little chickadees and the hummingbirds all leave. So I knocked on the window. And all the starlings just kind of half glanced at me. Like they didn't even care that I was there. Mm-hmm. And they went back to ignoring me. So I knocked on the window harder. And this time, the starlings, maybe about 30 of them, lifted off the grass. And they turned into the light before landing right back where they were. But it was in that moment when they turned into the light that I saw, if you've ever seen starlings up close, you see that their feathers are iridescent. And they sort of caught the light, and I got this kind of rainbow glow of their oil slick colored feathers. And I thought to myself, you know, I hate starlings, but they're so pretty. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I have to admit, they're really pretty. And it was in that moment that I recalled a story that I just mentioned in earlier books about Mozart having a pet starling. And I'd heard it repeated here and there, and I didn't know if it was an apocryphal story or an actually true story. But I thought, you know, that's a story worth exploring. That's the dissonance I just felt is the same one I think about when I think about Mozart being inspired by this despised bird. So I just couldn't get it out of my head after that. And I just went down the rabbit hole of research, which led me, you know, not only to my own sidewalk and to sort of urban starling watching, but and all of the scientific papers and the symphony and music experts. And I also went to Vienna and Salzburg to study the places that Mozart engaged with, his own starling, the home that he lived in when he had a starling, and all of that. So, I just followed it as far as I could.
Followed it. And then, Lyanda, you became the starling outlaw. Well, when did you decide, when did you, and why did you become the starling outlaw?
Well, in spite of all of the research that I did, I realized that there was a piece missing that I didn't have that would help me to understand Mozart's relationship with the starling that he lived with. I learned that he, it is a true story. He did live with a starling. He lived with the bird for 3 years before it died. I thought, if I'm going to really come to understand that relationship, what I need is a starling in my house, too. Mm-hmm. So the point at which I became an outlaw is kind of, it's kind of sketchy story, Chris. Let me preface it by saying that it is completely illegal to touch or disturb the nest, eggs, or nestlings of almost any bird in North America. There are a few exceptions, and one of them is the starling. Because it's a non-native invasive species, we're not only allowed, but we're actually encouraged by the Fish and Wildlife Departments to remove nests and eggs where we find them and to prevent, you know, to cover openings where starlings might nest in the future, all of that. Mm-hmm. So it is not illegal to actually take a starling. It is, however, illegal to raise one lovingly in your house. We're allowed to take one and wring its neck, but we're not allowed okay. to take one home and keep it. So that's the point that I became the outlaw, mm-hmm. is actually keeping the starling that I stole. So I know you want to know how I stole it, and I want to say something for the book, but I will say that there is a public restroom in a park near my home, and I have a friend who knew that I was on the lookout for a starling chick, who told me that they were going to remove the nest. The city was going to remove them. And I thought, okay, they can't do that because the chicks are already born. As I've been paying attention to a lot of the nests in the neighborhood, so I knew that I could hear, although I couldn't see the nest because they were way up and way far back under the eaves of the bathroom, I could hear this chirring sound that young, very young starlings make. So I knew they were in there. And he said, well, you know, they're just starlings. We just sweep them out. And I thought, wow. So I thought, I'm going to get me one of those birds on its way to the city garbage can. Mm-hmm. And I did. It was a harrowing tale of
daring do.
Daring do, cooperation, arguing, feats of physical strength and stupidity by myself and my husband. Mm-hmm. But we did come home with a baby starling.
And you've had experience as an Audubon-trained bird rescuer, or you've done that in the past, correct?
Right. It wasn't related to Audubon, but I did work in rehab before in Vermont. And I've raised a lot of birds mm-hmm. of all different kinds. Mm-hmm. And even though it was a raptor center, people would bring all kinds, you know, for birds of prey, injured birds of prey, people would bring all kinds of birds there. And one of the things I discovered was that people would bring baby starlings in that they'd found that had fallen from the nest or something. And our official policy at the Raptor Center was that we would euthanize them because they were non-native invasive. Mm-hmm. And I thought, because it was always kids that would bring them in with their mom standing behind them, you know, and they thought they were doing a really good deeds. So I thought, you know what? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to teach a different lesson, which is it's just one starling. There are 200 million starlings in the country. This one starling is not going to make a difference. This little kid is holding in his hand with his bad eyes, you know, that is injured bird. So I would just raise those starlings for a while until they were strong and then give them back to the kids to
release.
You
take their phone number.
Yeah. I had to do it on my own time. And, so I would let the kids release them, which I thought taught them more about compassion for life than, you know, give me the bird, I'll wring its neck for you.
Yes.
You know?
Or lying to them. That's great.
Lying to them.
So let's get back to Mozart. How did he acquire his bird? And tell us a little bit about the legend of the starlings. song at that point?
Okay. So Mozart lived in Vienna in an apartment over the street. And we know from a little notebook that he carried with him that he was writing, he was taking some time, for just a short period of time, he recorded every purchase he made. And thank goodness it was during the time that he got the Starling, because then we can really verify that this is a thing that happened. So he wrote down in his notebook that he paid 3 kreutzer for a Starling bird at this shop. And they had, birds were a really common and sort of popular, they were just kind of coming into their own as a popular pet for people that were in the socialite scene.
Oh, and also living in the city in small quarters.
And, right. Mm-hmm. So he went into the shop, and what the story goes that he heard the bird sing a motif from his concerto in G. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that that must also be true. One way or another, this bird in the shop heard the refrain from his concerto or something similar and was able to mimic it. So I'm going to pause there because most people, while people in Europe where starlings are native, know that starlings are excellent mimics. They imitate human voices, human music, other animals, household and environmental sounds. They're as good as parrots at mimicking sounds and better than crows and ravens. So they're fabulously talented mimics. So Mozart would have known that. And from our end, it's not a surprise that the bird could mimic the music, but how he came to know the song when it was something we know that at that time Mozart was keeping secret and hadn't performed publicly yet. So it's kind of this great musical ornithological mystery.
And but you the way that we went and did some research on that and revealed, you know, what you think happened in this book. So that's a great part of the story as well. I'm going to pause here because for our musical lovers and listeners, let's play a little bit of the Piano Concerto number 17 in G. And this is from the third movement. And the theme is what Mozart thought or did hear from his starling. And so here we go. We're talking to Lyanda Lynn Haupt, and she has written a book called Mozart's Starling. So Mozart went on, and you went on to visit Salzburg and Vienna, and it was the starling was in Vienna with him, correct? In a second floor apartment.
That's right.
Was it the Domgasse? The Domgasse apartment. Was it the Domgasse apartment or?
That's right. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And that apartment still is extant in Vienna, which is wonderful because most of Mozart's residences don't exist anymore. But that one has become a museum that is sort of set up to reflect the flow of what historians think the household might have looked like and how it sort of worked. So that was fabulous for my research. I could just let my imagination run wild, imagining Mozart there composing with the starling on his shoulder.
Mm-hmm. Life, and he named it, we don't know what he named it. So in your book, you call it Star, short for starling. Is that correct?
I do, yeah. Because, and there's a reason for that. Mm-hmm. So the reason that we know that the starling sang Mozart's song is that in that little notebook he had, he wrote down the motif the way that he wrote it and the way that the starling sang it, which was a couple, he sharped a G, the starling did, and added a fermata, a long pause. So Mozart wrote those side by side right next to the place that he wrote that he bought the starling. So that connects those two, you know, happenings together.
Okay, so you're imagining kind of in a mostly empty museum kind of apartments what the life would be like for Mozart and his wife Costanza, and they had two young children and they had students and then they had this starling. So paint us a little picture of what you imagine that that life, because you actually experienced life with your own starling. That helped a lot.
Exactly. So our starling that we live with flies you know, we let her out of her aviary as much as we can. And I know that she wants to be, she doesn't fly loose around the house. She just wants to be on us, on our head, on our shoulder, on our hands, involved with what we're doing, whether it's writing or dishwashing. She just gets right in there and is part of the action. And she has no interest in going off by herself. And so I thought, I wonder if this is what Mozart experienced and if he let the bird out of the cage, because we know the cages that they had for birds then were quite small. But also in researching the relationship with between households and birds in the 1700s, I learned that they often let them out, and kids out of the cages, and the kids played with them, and we see them in portraits perching on their families' shoulders and arms. So there was a level of interaction. And in imagining what it was like for Mozart and the starling, I took into account that, as you say, it was a chaotic household, that there were people coming and going all the time. There was music happening all the time. And we know from letters that people wrote who visited the Mozart household that he just sat there composing amidst all the chaos. It was just a lively musical household. And so it doesn't seem, given the norms of the time and what we know about Mozart, not just about that tolerance for chaos, but also his love of animals. He grew up with dogs and birds, mostly canaries, and he had this fondness for animals his whole life. And so it really leads me to believe that he did let his bird star out of the cage, and it was part of his process. And another clue for me is the thing he, when his starling died, he wrote a poem, an elegy for it. And one of the big centers of that poem was his understanding of the starling personality and the fondness he felt for this bird and its sense of mischievousness, things that he wouldn't have known unless he interacted with it very directly. So I think that's really fun to ponder. And
Okay, so I know everybody who's listening is thinking, but this is a very decorative era. People wore powdered wigs and beautiful clothes and, you know, and they went to the king's drawing rooms and parlors. And how could he possibly live with this little pooping creature? So this is the opening for this talk about, first of all, you, Lyanda, are living with a pooping creature. Who
I am.
Why do little birds poop so much? And how could this be possible?
Yes. Well, oh, I like your question about why do they poop so much. It's a biology question. So birds need to fly, so they have to be as light as possible all the time. So they are pooping machines. They just, any just little fraction of an ounce or gram that you would get from the poop held in the body is eliminated as quickly as possible. So birds are just pooping all the time, and that's why. So they can fly. And Carmen, of course, is a pooper. And when we have her out, I often put on an old shirt or I end up with poop in my hair. I always have a tissue that I can wipe poop up when she poops on my computer screen, which she does.
What about the keyboard? I'm thinking harpsichord keyboard and computer keyboard.
Right. So
it goes in there,
in
between.
You have to wipe it up quickly. But here's the truth. The truth is that starling poop is very small. It's not very big. It's not a big splat like you see
seagulls.
Some gulls or something like that. Or even robins make bigger poops than starlings do. So it's not very big. It's easy to wipe up. And the other thing about, you know, the period, you know, this classical period that Mozart lived in Vienna, is they just weren't that clean. They, you know, they didn't bathe. They had these wigs. I think the poop would just blend in just like it does in my own hair. I just let it dry. And
dry,
then it
yes.
Dry, and I realize sometimes that when I go out into the world that let I've the, forgotten.
Let the wig cleaner deal with it.
Exactly. So my feeling is that Mozart dealt with it in the same way I do. You just wipe it off when it comes. And the other thing that I talk about in the book is that Mozart and his family had a rambunctious sense of humor and made poop jokes and worse all the time together. So we were, at those times, you know, our sanitation is so good. We were flushing poop away, but poop was very, this is a long poop conversation.
It's okay. I think it's fascinating.
It was closer to the surface of life then, you know, right. It wasn't this sort of alien, you know, thing that was whisked away so quickly all the time.
They didn't have running water then. They had to go out.
They didn't.
They had to go out to the alley, to the communal outhouses, so to speak, I guess. But, you know, we have a little bit of a picture of Mozart from the movie and the play Amadeus, which, you know, took a lot of license with what's known about his life, right? But the part that you're saying is true based on his letters is that, you know, he could be very scatological and joke about, you know, sex and poop and, you know, the family had all these little jokes. And so we'll leave our dear readers to find out more about that. But it's not completely off base. Well, okay, from the ridiculous to the more sublime, let's talk about birdsong and starlings versus our native songbirds that we kind of treasure their song and think of them as being beautiful. And, you know, just let's talk about starlings and what kinds of sounds they make.
Okay, I can actually hear Carmen singing downstairs right now. She's, you know, she's got a lot of light on her, so she's sort of inspired by the daylight to sing this long, sort of multifaceted song that all starlings sing. And I'll interject here, because if you have people that know a lot about birds and songbirds in particular listening, they know that it's typically male birds that do the singing, what we consider bird song, that sort of beautiful, species-specific song that advertises their territory, that sort of defends their territory, that helps them attract a mate, all of that during the breeding time. So it's typically, you know, females have vocalizations, but not a song. But that's not true with starlings. Both males and female starlings sing, and they sing almost year-round, more and more intensely in the breeding time, but it's autumn, and Carmen and the starlings outside are singing too. So they start out with this sort of warbling, kind of long, chattering, kind of pretty murmuring part of their song, and then it goes into a whistle and some rattles and some clicks if you're a male, and then another kind of crescendo whistle at the end. And in between the first two parts of the song and the last parts of the song, they insert their own personal repertoire. That includes just songs that the individual bird likes to sing or has a habit of singing that's unique to them. They throw in their mimicked pieces of their, you know, favorite things they like to mimic. And so it makes this long, beautiful, recognizable, yet completely individual song. So
some birds,
it's constant background in my household.
Right. So some birds, they have mostly their instinctive species song.
Right.
But what you're saying is that the starling does have that, but also picks up sort of the ambient sounds around, not just music, but maybe what would be an example of just something that Carmen thought she liked and stuck into her repertoire.
Well, she likes the sound of our cat's meow.
Oh.
And because the cat is fed close to her aviary, she has picked up the meow that the cat makes, not the happy one, but the one that she makes when she's walking around her food bowl asking for food. So it's the meow.
Oh, dear.
And she sounds, it's perfect. She mimics the sound of the wine cork coming out of the wine bottle. That's actually the first mimic sound she made, which is sort of, I don't know what that says about me, but she mimics the common words she hears. She mimics, hi, Carmen, hi, honey. She says, kiss me. She makes that little sound that you used to call animals that, uh-huh. you know, we do with her, and she does right. it back to us. And then many sounds of our household, besides the cat, the creak of the wood floor, the beep of the microwave oven, and the whir of the coffee grinder. I could just go on and on of the sounds that she's mm-hmm. picked up. One thing about starlings, though, is that you can't really teach them a specific sound because they're very, I would say contrary, but I don't know if I'm projecting onto her because I really hoped that she would learn, you know, the Mozart's
right.
motif.
And of
I
course,
played it over you, and over for
and
her.
And probably other pieces of beautiful music.
But, right, and bird songs. And but then, she's very particular. She just says what she wants to say.
And then I'm sure you listen to a lot of Mozart, and there's a particular piece that you write about, which is known as a musical joke. And mm-hmm. then he wrote after the death of his starling, and people just didn't understand this piece of music. Because he likes harmony and beautiful music, or, you know, harmonics and resolution and, mm-hmm. you know, kind of kept away from dissonance. But your idea about this musical joke, divertimento, is?
Well, first let me credit mm-hmm. the idea to Meredith West, mm-hmm. An ethologist, a student of animal behavior, who wrote about it way back in the 1990s, that there was this piece that musicians hate to play, a musical joke, because, as you say, it's discordant, it's kind of wild. People say that Mozart just lost his way or just was maybe, you know, tipsy when he wrote it, but it was just a bad example of Mozart's music. Mm-hmm. And if you read it, if you kind of overlay it, the time of composition of this piece, you find that he was working on it during the time that he lived with a starling, and then he finished it soon after his starling died.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And then when you overlay the musical song of the starling upon some of the most questionable cadenzas in a musical joke, you find that there's a lot that matches up. And so even Meredith West gave the recording and starling recordings to a famous ornithologist, and he totally agreed. So people are finding the connection between the idea that the starling that he lived with was not just, you know, a fun pet, but served as a muse sometimes. And the creation, perhaps in the creation of other music, but enough to even include some imitation, you know, in a piece.
There is so much that you talk about in terms of science and language acquisition and creativity in your book, which I have to, you know, highly recommend for our audience. And I'd like to close with talking about the word a murmuration of starlings, because mm-hmm. I had never heard that before, or at least I've forgotten it. So talk a little bit about the magic of the murmuration.
So a murmuration are those large flocks of starlings that we see starting now, like I said at the beginning, when the family groups after summer breakdown, they start flocking up into larger and larger flocks. And they reach their peak over agricultural areas, both here and in Europe, where they'll gather into sometimes tens of thousands and up to a million starlings all in one big flock. But in cities and towns where we are, we'll see perhaps up to 1,000 birds, but even here in Seattle, a couple hundred, a few hundred birds at a time.
A thousand birds. So picture them like just like this gigantic flock all moving synchronistically through the sky. And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave Lyanda there and thank her so much for joining us today. Please join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Go to the podcast page and listen to more of Book Lovers Cafe. Thank you, Jacob, and thank you, Carl, for smoothing out all the rough edges in these programs, and thanks to all the volunteers and supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible. We'll see you next time.